Hello, and welcome to The Regrettable Century. I'm Chris.
I'm Kevin.
And I'm Jason.
And we have with us a special guest, our friend Jess. Say hi, Jess.
Hi.
So Jess is a friend of ours who has thoughts about the thing we're talking about tonight. So we invited her on to talk with us about her thoughts. And the thing we're talking about tonight is capitalist realism dying?
No.
All right.
Yeah,
good
I'm with Jess.
I think Jess pretty much summed up my thoughts as well, so I feel like I'm pretty good.
Yeah.
I did the podcast.
Solid.
You're welcome. A lot faster than you guys do it.
Yeah, we're dumb guys, you know?
Yeah.
We just sit around and fucking run off at the mouth because we like hearing ourselves talk to each other. Anyway, you know, we've talked about capitalist realism before, specifically...
A bit, yeah.
Yeah. You know, I mean, it's a Mark Fisher book that we all read and enjoyed, and we find that it is a very good way to describe the cultural mood under which we exist in this, like, whatever you want to call it, neoliberalism, late capitalism, or if you don't like either of those words, just capitalism. But yeah, so the prevailing mood, the prevailing cultural mood, I would say. And what is that mood, Jason? Could you help describe what late capitalism is as understood by Mark Fisher?
I think the first thing to say is the reason we're talking about this again, because we did talk about, you know, whatever, the concept of capitalist realism kind of weaves its way all throughout all of our discussions. But I think that's because we're convinced to some degree that it's a useful category. But lately the question has been raised, and actually gets raised every couple of years. Have we seen the end of capitalist realism? So what is it? That's, I guess, how we can determine whether or not we've seen the end. And to just pull right out of the book, capitalist realism is the widespread sense that not only is capitalism the only viable political and economic system, like in Margaret Thatcher's words, there is no alternative to capitalism, but also that it is impossible even to imagine a coherent alternative to it. It's a pervasive atmosphere conditioning not only the production of culture, but also the regulation of work and education, acting as a kind of invisible barrier constraining thought and action.
Now, okay, so knowing what the definition of capitalist realism is, do we think we've seen the end of it?
No.
So it's become almost cliche if you're writing for today's left publications that, you know, there's this statement, this quote attributed mostly to Frederick Jameson or to Slavoj Žižek, that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than imagine the end of capitalism. And because of any number of sort of exciting political moments in the last several years, various people on the left have said, now I can imagine the end of capitalism. And so capitalist realism is over. And I think that if that's all it means is that individual writers of, you know, basically material for the content mills of left media, if they're able to imagine like social struggle, then yeah, capitalist realism is a useless term. But I think it warrants some deeper investigation, right? So like there was once a period in history where millions of people considered themselves to be communists or socialists, and they could imagine an end of the capitalist system, and they could, you know, what that meant for them was something that they could articulate in terms of they had a vision of the cooperative commonwealth of, you know, the new Soviet man or whatever it was. And I think that that's the kind of thing that I think we should be investigating, is whether or not we have the capacity to genuinely conceive of the horizon and the world beyond the horizon, not the conceive of the possibility of resistance, of struggle, of opposition, right? But of
right.
Coordinated, organized opposition with a vision for where to go.
It seems to me that any time there is a bubbling of like movement or of resistance of some sort, that it all of a sudden becomes, you know, easy to envision the end of this period and the breaking open of a new period. And in my couple decades on the left, I've seen that happen in cycles like a few times, right? Where so say the Arab Spring, everyone thought, oh, okay, this is a new cycle, a new breaking open of resistance. This is finally, we can see what revolutions look like, and the stranglehold of capitalism is going to weaken, starting to weaken. And what we ended up getting after the Arab Spring was something even worse than what was there before. All I'm saying is that I've seen this happen, like, you know, half a dozen times in the past 2 decades of me being on the left. And every single time people think that a new period is breaking open and things are about to shift and, you know, it's time to go all out and do the thing that we've been doing over and over and over and over again for the past, did we decide it was 60 years? And maybe this time it'll work.
Chris, when you said that, I was thinking back about the cycles of resistance and protests popping up around whatever given topic of the day happens, you know, is the issue. And I started thinking back through, there's the Black Lives Matter protests. There was the Occupy Wall Street protests, the Arab Springs. You know, I'm like cycling back through these, and that what you're saying makes sense. But then I got back to the World Trade protests in Seattle, the anti-globalization or whatever, humane, however people want to talk about it now, humane globalization, whatever protests that happened in Seattle in, what was it, 99, late 90s?
Yeah.
And then I was like, I can't conjure up in my mind a prior one, like, since the 70s. It strikes me that the neoliberal period, you know, taking root in the late 70s, lasting through the 90s,
being fully revealed in all of its horror in the 90s, after the threat of the Soviet Union goes away, the Democrats and Republicans mm-hmm. are like, well, hey, there's no alternative, now we can do whatever the fuck we want.
Exactly. But something new, that, like, there's a shift. There is a shift. There's something new happening there, where we get the appearance of these cycles of mass protests and resistance. Now, I think it's, you know, entirely true to criticize these protests and the way that the left, whatever, however we conceive of the thing that we call the left, as, you know, it's entirely valid to, like, criticize these things as, you know, doomed and completely headed in the wrong direction and going about things in the wrong way. But it strikes me that there is something different about the appearance of this cycle of mass upheaval and protest that wasn't replicated across the 80s and 90s, at least in the first world.
So I think this is hitting on something really interesting, because I think that it illustrates the necessity of making a distinction between neoliberalism as like a political project and capitalist realism as the kind of cultural outgrowth of neoliberalism's effects. So, you know, with the decline of the social mobilizations of the 60s and 70s, you get a relative lull in mass struggle, because there's an anti-nuclear movement, there's an anti-apartheid movement, there's lots and lots of localized struggles and, you know, sector-specific sounds wrong. That's not the right way to put it. But, like, issue campaigns around AIDS, around the Equal Rights Amendment. You know, there's, in the 90s, there is a kind of social movementism around environmental questions, even a small anti-war movement with the first Gulf War, but they really, like, pale in comparison.
Well, there's also the Rodney King riots,
sure,
and the anti-police brutality movement as well.
Yeah.
But I think that, you know, part of neoliberalism really solidifying itself in the United States, like, manifests itself on the left in the form of lifestyle activism.
Right. And so it is the case that there is a return to large-scale social movements. And it actually is not as recent as what we're talking about. It's the late 90s and early 2000s. Then there's another lull, right? When Fisher writes about the environment, the invisible barrier constraining thought and action that he calls capitalist realism, he writes it in 2009. He writes it in reference to the return of mass struggle, because what he's talking about is a mass struggle which does not define itself as anything other than resistance to the effects of neoliberalism, as opposed to, you know, when young people in the United States, by and large, sympathized not just with the Third World Revolutions, but wanted to make their own, right? When the Black Panther Party stood for not just civil rights, but for Black power, and so on, or the old left, when, you know, it talked of revolution, and they all meant it to some degree. The capitalist realism is most on display when we talk about the return to mass struggle, because of the way it is constrained in thought and action as resistance, broadly speaking, to the effects of the system, rather than attempt to transcend it, to move beyond it, to and even in toppling governments across the Middle East in 2011, it was like Mubarak out, you know. But then what? And it's like nobody knew. The left didn't know. And the best expression of capitalist realism is when a political party in Greece, which is born entirely out of the social mobilizations of the 2000s, and then, you know, it's street activists who build a political party based on their talents as resistors to the effects of basically the Americanization of the world, and they take power, and then they administer austerity themselves. Because there's just no ability to think beyond the constraints put on us by the neoliberal world order. So these things are related, right? But they're not the same thing. And I think that's the reason why people keep saying, oh, we've found the end of capitalist realism, because now there's Occupy Wall Street. It's like, oh, that wasn't it. It's actually the end of capitalist realism because of Bernie Sanders and Jeremy Corbyn. But in every case, what we haven't yet really figured out how to do is to articulate a politics that actually conceives of an end to capitalism itself. We have an end to austerity, maybe, but not even that, right? Or whatever, changes to the way that we're policed or something, but barely anything approximating like a real sense that there is a future. I don't think we truly believe there's a future.
No. I mean, I think that given the world that we've inherited, if everything goes the way that it has continued, that it has been going, if it continues to go that way, then there isn't a future. There are no decent prospects on the horizon anywhere without some sort of massive rupture that is, as of yet, unforeseen. So I have no faith in anything happening that will change our prospects.
Yeah,
given the way the world is.
I was going to say, like, not to interpret it too literally, but it's like, it's at a point where, I mean, it really is literally easier to imagine the end of the world coming first, considering, like, the climate crisis is pretty much set on track to, like, destroy the planet. So, I, just in terms of, like, time almost, I can't imagine that we're going to kind of keep having this pattern repeat, and it's going to end differently in time to save anything.
In fact, I imagine the end of the world and then the end of capitalism.
Yeah. Right.
The end of the world as we know it, like some sort of full-scale civilizational collapse, and then we build, I don't know, we build socialism in the remains of civilization.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's like the first episode that we did, or the second one or whatever, I think we said another end of the world is possible.
Yeah.
And if there was a slogan that really like summed up the way that we think about things, it's that. Well, and so like on the subject of the climate crisis, we read an article that referred to the popularity of the Green New Deal as one example of the shattering edifice of capitalist realism, which is remarkable for a couple of reasons to me. The first one is that the Green New Deal is not conceived of and articulated as a non-market approach to climate solutions. It does not incorporate into its it does not have incorporated into it the breaking of the dominance of market logic of the neoliberal world order. But also, the author of the article said that it is not environmentally sustainable, and also is predicated on the hyper exploitation of the third world. Now, even if those things are all true, and let's take the author at their word for the sake of a discussion, that hardly reimagines the world in non-capitalist terms. Just on the face of it, that is very, very easily contained within the maintenance of the existing social order, just with constraints. Now, I think it's worth suggesting that you have to make transitional demands and popularize a program that people can conceive of as realistic so that they'll fight for it. But the whole conversation, right, the whole point here is we're trying to determine the limits of what people conceive of as realistic, because nominally we intend to raise the bar.
That reminds me also, like, a little off the topic of the Green New Deal, but all of these, like, the big oil companies, but, like, Chevron specifically had this campaign, and they're apparently still dumping money into this for, like, carbon capture technology, where they build gigantic machines that...
Like scrubbers?
They do what trees do, and...
Yeah, well, good.
Yeah, and they capture carbon out of the air and, like, filter it or some shit, but... Besides the fact that there's, you know, been studies here and there that it wouldn't be effective enough, this is just like, first of all, it's just optics. Like, it's just the same thing that Exxon did with, like, their algae campaign. Like, it's, they're trying to make it seem like they're the ones working towards this and they care about it. Meanwhile, like, something like carbon capture, they're trying to do that so they can... at the same time continue, they're just trying to, like, offset the damage they're already doing. So it's, and to see that kind of thing, like, I knew about this because when I was in college, my, like, astronomy 101 teacher showed us a YouTube video about it and was like, isn't this cool? And I was like, fucking no.
No, it's not. It's a really good example of what Badiou called the cosmetic changes on the edifice. Right. Right.
Yeah. Sort of like I keep bringing up the painting Black Lives Matter on the street while doing absolutely nothing to address police brutality.
Right. Like one of my favorite May 68 slogans is no replastering, the structures are rotten. And the fact that that's like a popular slogan that's spray painted on the walls of the universities and on the town squares and, you know, at the occupied factories suggests to me that they had at that moment a different conception of what they were trying to do. Now, they failed, and there are plenty of political organizational reasons to talk through about why that is, but it is the case that the mood of the moment, of the mood of the movement, was we don't want to just reform this because that's not good enough, as opposed to right now explicitly the only thing that we can conceive of is to reform this. And it's not even... This isn't like, oh, yeah, people are stupid, right? And this, you know, a value judgment. It's just a recognition of where we actually are. Because if we don't get that right, then I don't think we get to a point where it's different.
I felt like the Capitalist, the Roar magazine article was probably the closest one to convincing for me.
Yeah.
I think primarily because the author explicitly is explicitly claiming... not that we've, you know, wholly transcended capitalist realism and now it's something totally different, but rather that he's seeing the world slightly transformed or slightly sort of nudged in a different direction. The capitalist realism, and he goes through in the article and analyzes, here are the three sort of component aspects that Fisher identifies as being, you know, this is representative or constitutive of capitalist realism, and here's how the world has shifted slightly in these specific ways. I think he makes an argument to my mind. I think that that's compelling enough to me that I can follow him to say in saying that something is brewing, and here's where we should look for that brewing change. I don't know if I follow him far enough to say that this is a quantitative change in the world. Most of what he identifies is slight alterations in a slightly different direction. So, for example, he identifies three categories. First, that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. Second, that the future is canceled. And third, that capitalist realist conditions are a class project. Now, if I understand him correctly, and, you know, correct me if you read him differently or if you feel like I'm misreading him. he goes through these and says that they're altered in the following ways. He says that it's easier to imagine the end of the world than the end of capitalism. And he's instead now he says, this is not to say that it's wrong for those of us, who can busy ourselves with post-capitalist imaginaries. It is to say that our capacity to do so implies that we are at a specific stage in our struggle's development. After decades of capitalist realism, we are once again learning to flex our utopian imaginations. We have become skilled time travelers and project. So he's suggesting that I think, Jason, what you were saying earlier, like his he refers to the Green New Deal as why we're not in capitalist realism anymore. He uses that among, you know, a handful of other things. He says that there is a transitional Green New Deal. There's also degrowth futures. There's eco-modernist utopias. There's fully automated luxury communes. There's decolonized agro-ecological matrices and even anti-authoritarian neo-feudalisms. And adds into the mix a reference to a genre of COVID-19 inspired post-pandemic, post-capitalist life worlds, where he's saying that not that any of these fully transcend capitalist realism, and not that any of these are even necessarily good ideas, but rather he's showing that there is a litany of growing imaginaries, places where people are starting to project into the future an altered reality that isn't like what we currently live in. And it identifies specifically capitalism as the thing that needs to be altered. So I follow him there, and I think that he's got something to say. I think that there's some validity in that. The second thing he says, the future is canceled. He notes that Fisher's claim was more of a cultural one. He seems to suggest that this one's actually gotten more entrenched, that it's shifted from cultural to literal future is canceled.
Yeah, I agree with that.
Which I'm not sure that actually supports his proposition. But then the third one was capitalist realism is a class project, and I think what he was arguing here is that the capitalist class seems fractured and at something of an impasse, is having trouble finding something that resembles a unified class project that which is what it used to have in the true capitalist realism. So I think I can follow if we want to say that, like, maybe these are signs that we're taking, the world is taking steps in a different direction. Let's pay attention to these new directions. I think that there's something there. I don't think that he's sufficiently made the case, at least to my mind, that this is a different, like, quantitatively different thing.
Sure. Like, I do think it is one thing to say that the popular slogans of around the world in the late 90s and early 2000s were anti-globalization, like world trade is the enemy. And that's a fairly low horizon, considering that it used to be revolution, brotherhood of man, whatever other things used to exist in the past. And that, like, an advance over that might be, however horrendously flawed I think it is, this notion that, we deserve a fully automated luxury communist future. But I think far more people were advancing the slogan of, of the various slogans of alter-globalization than are advancing the slogan of fully automated luxury communism today. Do we think that the ability of, like, basically Verso books authors and Jacobin writers and, people sharing memes to popularize fully automated luxury communism, does that equate to a popular politics that imagines a real future? Like, do we see that on display? Because that's where I think we would see, like, real cracks in what we're calling capitalist realism.
Yeah, I was going to ask that before when we were first, like, defining capitalist realism. Like, when we talk about the end of capitalism, and it, are we including in that definition, like, what it's being replaced by, because for me, not only can I not actually imagine the end of capitalism, but more so, I really can't imagine what we would replace it with, especially because I don't think we all have a unified idea of that.
I was going to say that I think that the only thing that he listed as evidence that people are starting to think outside of the box of capitalist realism was the Green New Deal. I mean, the only thing that he mentioned that has any side, any kind of like social weight, mm-hmm. was the Green New Deal. It's the only thing that's actually being like called for by a significant amount of people. And he says in the same sentence that it's exploitive of the third world and isn't going to fix anything, you know? So it's like, I don't know. I'm finding it hard to be inspired by that, especially since it's like got no chance of even being adopted by the opposition party in the United States where it's most needed. To me, it's not nothing that Bernie Sanders and, you know, AOC are in the national spotlight and mentioning that something needs to change. I don't think that means there are cracks in capitalist realism, because social democratic programs existed under capitalism just fine for a really long time and have sort of at this point been subsumed into capitalism.
Well, I think that that illustrates Jess's point pretty well. That
even when
we talk about an opposition to capitalism and a vision for a better world, we don't all necessarily mean the same thing. And the existence of like in the Tribune article, the quasi-Keynesian budgets, discourse around MMT, musing about a universal basic income, like none of that to me aggregates to like a bold new vision for a world without exploitation, without alienation, where, you know, the condition for the free development of each is the condition for the free development of all. You know, like, we had loftier visions for most of our movement's history.
Right.
Of course. Yeah, sure. A broad popularization of social democracy is positive. I don't even think we have that, really.
If the question is, are we seeing the end of capitalist realism? Then I would say the answer would have to unequivocally be no. I mean, we're seeing the return of reforming capitalism, like maybe putting its human face back on.
Right, but even then, like, I think it's significant that Corbyn got defeated and replaced by Keir Starmer, that Sanders got defeated and the president of the United States is Joe Biden, of all people. Like,
the figure that represents least of all the Democratic, like, I don't know, maybe... Fucking, what's his rat face? What's his name?
Oh, yeah, Buttigieg.
Buttigieg.
Yeah. Rat face.
Yeah, you know.
The Biden represents the person who least embodies any chance of reform on the Democratic Party.
So I mentioned those things to make a particular point, because it's not like losing a round means that there is no war to be fought. Because, like, William Foster never got elected president on the Communist Party ticket either, right? But we didn't call that era capitalist realism. So there's more to it than just, you know, how much are we winning? Because if that's it, then the whole discussion's not all that important. The bigger question is like, how does the intangible barrier to our thought and action affect our thought and action? So, like, the aspirations of the left don't even include a broad agreement about an independent existence of the left. Like, who are the Workers' Party people? They're the obnoxious weirdos that you hope you don't bump into because they came to, like, you know, counter-recruit from your socialist group into theirs, right?
Yeah.
So what you're left with is a socialist vision for the world that is, well, maybe after Ocasio-Cortez has, like, a lot of experience in the Senate, that she'll be a lot like Bernie Sanders, only younger and a woman. And, like, obviously, I think that would be great, but, like, that's a very low horizon. That's a very low bar to set. Or like, you know, what is the collective subject envisioned by this left? Is it even the working class? And when we say the working class, what do we mean by that? What are the ambitions of this left to be the political expression of the working class? How are those things articulated and as plans for organizing the working class? Those things all seem largely absent. Or so abstract as to be actually useless to political discussions that happen inside of what we have that passes for a left in this country. So those, to me, are those are the wages of capitalist realism, is an inability to, like, you know, we think in smaller and smaller boxes. The more successful that we seem to be in recruiting new people to socialism, it's on a thinner and thinner basis, with an even narrower view than when there were only a few thousand of us.
That's kind of part of what I was saying before also, because if we're going to talk about replacing it with someone better, it's like, or something better, it's like, who is and how are we doing that? Yeah. We don't have the materials for that at all.
Yeah, especially not human material.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah, speaking of human material, what would our left even conceive of as a political subject?
Yeah.
You talk to any self-proclaimed socialist, are they going to say that it's the proletariat, the working class? Like, they're not. I mean, because the extent of the vision of most of these new to socialism socialists is to keep Marvel putting new women of color as their leads. I mean, I don't mean to be dismissive of the idea that representation is important, but it's nothing on its own. Their idea of achieving goals is to address individual oppressions and not to deal with a system that imposes them.
Right. There's no concern for women of color. There's concern for a woman of color getting to be in the elite position that used to be reserved for white men, you know.
Right.
Right. Well, like, the girl bossing is like the girl bosses are the revolutionary subject. Mm-hmm.
Well, even on the better, more forward thinking parts of the left, because it's not all just a liberal swamp.
Oh, I know.
But no, I mean, your point is a good one. But I also think that, like, even where you find the best expressions of a utopian imaginary in the defund and or abolish the police discourse, that has been touted, and not without reason, as a sign of the maturity of this left. And then yesterday it fucking fell apart completely. And what we really want more than anything in the world, even more than defunding the police, is for those police to shoot all of my uncle's friends. And not my uncle personally, but, you know, just mean like right-wing uncles are the ones that stormed the Capitol building. And it wasn't a rowdy protest of lunatics on the fringe. It was a coup. It was terrorism. It was an existential threat to our sacred democracy. That same sacred democracy that yesterday, no, 2 days ago, last week, was an abhorrent system of unrelenting oppression and exploitation that had to be done away with, right? And we couldn't imagine how to do it, but we did know that the cops needed to go because they were the arm of the state. That was one thing we were sure of. And now we don't even fucking think that anymore. That's what I mean when I say that the capitalist realism is more than just an ability to articulate a politics of struggle or even an idea of socialism, but that our convictions are skin deep. The same cops that will shoot another black kid tonight in any number of neighborhoods around this country are presently the thin blue line standing between us, in our imaginations anyways, between us and the, you know, the Fourth Reich. And not only is that delusional, but it's also, I mean, what it suggests is that we don't really think the things that we profess to believe. This was actually a moment for the left to be constructive, to go on the offensive, and to raise the political horizons of the country. And what we did instead was say, help us, please, cops, liberals, anyone but us.
Yeah, I mean, I'm seeing long-time comrades, self-proclaimed communists, talking about how these people are traitors and how they deserve to go to prison.
Remember when we were the traitors?
Yeah.
When we were the terrorists? I mean, yeah.
And the insurrectionists? Yeah.
Like, it's actually incredible. It's disgusting.
Mm-hmm.
And even surprising. Like, I wasn't pessimistic enough.
Yeah. Turns out.
To foresee so-called socialists, so-called comrades, like, calling for people doing civil disobedience to be beaten, shot, arrested, put in prison.
Yeah.
I don't have anything... Yeah. I have nothing in common with these fucking people.
Right. Like, and it's got nothing to do with sympathy. This is not a broad, like, it is right to rebel no matter what and no matter who you are. But it's like the
yeah, fuck those, when those fucking weirdo losers who were
no, it's
tried
yeah,
to do
fuck
that
those
shit.
People, obviously. But you know, when the silver right. shirts were a problem, when the Ku Klux Klan was a problem, it was, you know, it was the Deacons for Defense. It was the you know, the SWP and IWW and Socialist Party organized like workers' defense squads. When the you know what we recognized
the Black
is,
Panther Party for Self-Defense.
Yes, exactly. What we recognized was that whatever the future was going to be was going to come down to a struggle between the classes, and there was that class with the liberal and conservative wing, and then there was our class, which also has its liberal and conservative wings, but it has a destiny as a class and in a politics as a class. We've given all that up, and for some reason we're saying capitalist realism is over because there are protests. Anyway, so I'm upset by this.
So like in the course of like, you know, a little bit more than a year, we've seen an immense amount of hope in a Bernie Sanders campaign doing something. You know, I was hopeful that maybe my student debt might go away and maybe we'd eventually get Medicare for all or something. I didn't think that capitalism was going to implode as a result, but I thought that maybe the crushing weight of my financial reality might be relieved a little bit. We went from that to the bungling of this pandemic response, or first of all, you know, we went from that optimism to Bernie Sanders being robbed by the Democrats again, you know, a coordinated rat fucking by Barack Obama and the DNC.
It's only the second time we've heard from him since he was president.
Mm-hmm. Right. The world is like going to hell, and the only thing Barack Obama can like deign to pick up the phone and rat fuck Bernie Sanders out of his possibility.
Shortly followed by stepping in to put down the basketball players' strike.
Yeah.
Right. What, dude? Seriously, like I know that this has been said elsewhere. And probably a lot more eloquently than I'm about to say it, but Barack Obama was the singularly most destructive political presence of the 21st century. And I think that that's probably true. But moving on from that, you know, the bungling of a pandemic response in a way that is just so, makes it so blatantly obvious that the ruling class, first of all, doesn't give a fuck about us at all, and second, couldn't do anything about it if they did.
Right.
You know? They're completely incapable of ruling in a crisis.
Well, and, you know, Lenin's conditions for revolution are twofold, right, there, that the rulers can no longer rule in the old way,
right,
and that the ruled will no longer submit to being ruled in the old way.
Mm-hmm. Right, but
it turns out we'll fucking submit no matter how we're ruled.
Yeah. Turns out we're some servile motherfuckers. Okay, so that brings up the George Floyd rebellion, right? Where it looks like something is breaking wide open. Mm-hmm. I mean, for a lot of people, it looks like that. I was a little more skeptical, and I think most of us were. But what was that even channeled into? Like, I mean, we got some small reforms in a couple of cities. Like, I know Kevin mentioned this in Portland, in Seattle. There's some police reforms that went on there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, there was, you know, some minimal reforms. We got some statues taken away. We got Black Lives Matter painted on the streets, and
we got a black vice president.
Oh yeah, that's true. A black cop vice president.
Yeah,
right.
We didn't. I mean, yeah, you know, it's good enough for a lot of people.
Yeah. And then, all of that momentum just evaporates, and whatever, I mean, it seems like it didn't evaporate. It seems like it channeled seamlessly into the Biden campaign. Mm-hmm. And whenever anyone tried to point out that, wait a minute, Kamala Harris is a cop, all of a sudden cops aren't that bad anymore, and we should shut the fuck up about all that cop stuff. And what are you trying to, you're trying to get Donald Trump reelected?
Right. Well, and, you know, that's not everybody on the left. It's a huge number of people on the left.
It was a huge number of people that were new to the left.
Right.
That had come to the left as a result of the past 4 years of Trump, and who are ostensibly just liberals who want more social safety net. That's a majority of the left, right?
Sure.
I would say, like, I could say that the left is only liberals, and the number of leftists who aren't are such a small statistical outlier that it doesn't even matter that I'm not including them.
Well, and, you know, a week ago I might have quibbled a little bit more. Before yesterday's events in D.C., when I, you know, saw everybody.
Before I found out that all my homies with their hammer and sickle knuckle tats are like actually just fucking liberals.
We saw the world's first, well, I guess this would be the second ever transformation of a butterfly back into a slug.
Butterflies aren't slugs.
No, that was, what was his name?
It's George Galloway. To quote a problematic fave from the last iteration of Mass Struggle. I need to get chapstick. I'm
George
dying
Galloway
over here.
Referred to Christopher Hitchens as having a reverse metamorphosis. Because Christopher Hitchens used to be a communist and then he turned into a neocon. So right. He said there was a reverse metamorphosis of a butterfly back into a slug.
Even though they come from caterpillars.
Yeah, everyone knows they come from fucking caterpillars, whatever.
That's not the point.
What they said, did he say a slug or a worm?
Ah, he said a worm. No, that's Braveheart.
Oh, that's Braveheart. I'll crush you like a worm.
It's all the same. All those guys.
Braveheart, George Galloway, whatever.
What's the difference, really?
Yeah, it's fucking Scottish people.
Absence of a revolutionary subject. While Jason's meandering around and making his way back, I can start to say something about that. I think that it strikes me that might be the missing link here. You know, like talking about Lenin's formulation for what's necessary for a revolution when we can conceive of a different world is when the ruling class can no longer go on in the old way and the subject class refuses to go on being ruled in the old way. It strikes me as what's a recurring theme here is the lack of a revolutionary subject, right? It seems like we are the appearance of imaginaries into the future, such as the Green New Deal, that has some actual political weight behind it, more so than the other ones. I'd say maybe the automated luxury communism one might be represented politically in like the Andrew Yang, you know, universal income thing. So there is, it's not substantial, but there's political weight behind it. But either way, what was I saying?
Could have been anything.
The inability of the ruling class to go on, Kai Herron's article where he identified, he had identifies that the future is canceled, is not just cultural anymore, but it's becoming literal in this new period. And his third point, that capitalist realism is a class project. I think in that section he argues that we're entering a period where there is less of a unified class project. There's less of a class project that unifies the ruling class. The ruling class does seem to be fracturing. It doesn't seem to know where to go or how to move forward, and is lurching left and right and in every different direction, floundering and trying to figure out what to do to move forward. But, as you said, we appear to be some servile motherfuckers and seem to be entirely content to go on being ruled in the old way. So there does seem to be something shifting in the ether, but that something doesn't seem to include a revolutionary subject. The working class is as just utterly asleep as it's ever been. It continues to be decreasing union density and decreasing numbers of significant strikes in the United States in line, in accordance with the unaltered downward slope of the union movement that since I think it was like the 50s or maybe the 60s, whenever it just started zooming downward, and it has not stopped since then. We're not organized as a class. We are utterly atomized and separated and pitted against each other in ways that I don't think could even have been imaginable 20, 30, 40 years ago. And even the individual, the left that exists today, the few of us who sit up and conceive of ourselves as trying to get past the capitalist world order, do so in ways of like in the most atomistic, individualized ways that you can possibly think of it, of doing that. Right, wrong, you know, whether somebody's got the right ideas or wrong ideas aside, like, we conceive of ourselves, we can't conceive of ourselves as anything other than like wearing cultural identifiers and projecting them to ourselves and to each other out into the world as like, yeah, hey, look at me, I'm super radical, I'm left wing, and that's resistance, you know, like that is the only resistance that exists. There is no unified collective class organization whatsoever. I think that maybe that is the sort of like the recurring theme here in this conversation that that indicates that we have not, despite the shifting dynamics of the ruling class, we have not reached the end of capitalist realism, is there is no revolutionary subject.
Yeah.
I would say that like while it does appear as though the ruling class is in turmoil right now, it is having a hard time going along ruling in the way that it did before. But when it really matters, the ruling class can get together and get things done. Still. Like, passing an enormous defense bill. There was a big split over whether or not the working class was going to get nothing or $600. And, There was a window of opportunity for maybe $2,000 to enter into the equation, actually brought on by Donald Trump and backed up by Bernie Sanders, that entered into the...
So, brought about by an alliance, a problematic red-brown alliance.
But, you know, there was a tiny window where, you know, this thing could have possibly happened. And what ended up happening was 46 Democrats, you know, jumped ship and made sure that it didn't happen. So those Democrats, when it really mattered, the ruling class was able to get the things that it wanted done, which was pass this defense spending bill and get everybody $600. One-time payment of $600 in the middle of a pandemic, right? After not having a payment since August. So, I mean, it seems as though they are not fractured enough yet at this point to where they cannot go on ruling in the same old way. It just means they're having a little bit harder of a time doing it as smoothly as they did before. That's what I think.
Right. Well,
and
I mean, that's
no, sorry, and with no challenge like from the left,
no
at
opposition
all,
party
because
at all.
Yeah, the
no.
left is right. just like a miscellany of convictions, doing mm-hmm. yeah. you know, not really like challenging capitalism in any real way.
Like that that article, the coronavirus is the end of history. Like the thesis of that article is that the coronavirus is killing off neoliberalism. And it's like the examples are Boris Johnson adopting large portions of the Corbyn labor program. And that you see all sorts of what we are to understand as being left political programs by centrist and right-leaning neoliberal governments. And my question is, doesn't that just illustrate the point of how low the horizons have been?
Yes.
If the centrist and center-right parties and governments of the world can just adopt what is regarded as a radical left program for dealing with the crisis, and they're just able to do it, that says to me that
it wasn't much of a radical left, program.
Right, there's not much of a radical left in existence. There's certainly no radical left pressure. Maybe circumstances are forcing capitalist states to act more state and less capital for a second, but that's not all that significant. But also, like, yeah, it does not come as the result of popular pressure. Mm-hmm. So
yeah.
Right. It's like a
easy come, easy go. As soon as they don't want to give it to us anymore, right. It'll be gone.
Right, and exactly. if we have a dialectical notion of how history works, the cracks in capitalist realism that we are hoping to see by raising things like a Green New Deal and you know, a Medicare for all and all the other stuff that we didn't get and aren't getting. But if the expectation was in struggling for those things, we would win some of them. And then, you know, the spell might be broken a little bit and that people might raise their sights a little bit, lift their heads up and see a little bit further down the road. And as a result of having achieved the reforms, you know, as we used to be so fond of saying in the ISO, that with the eating comes the appetite, and that the relationship between the struggle for reforms and the Herculean struggles that would take to win them and the raising of the horizon would actually produce those cracks, that would produce that collective revolutionary subject, that would produce a genuinely radical left expression, a revolutionary expression of class politics. If it comes about because governments feel a need to bail out companies instead, if that comes about, if these things come about because states think it's necessary in order to maintain profitability that they come about, and we're not a part of the equation, mm-hmm. then our horizons don't go anywhere. They certainly don't rise.
Right.
And it's in the, you know, when this author, I forget their name, but they stand in for a whole kind of person on the left. What they seem to be doing is hoping that history will act for us, rather than to flow from our actions. So like we'll just somehow get into objectively better circumstances, and then we'll act better because of it. And that's precisely the opposite of how history works.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
Why would conditions change for the better without us doing anything?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Right. Everybody's, you know, maybe this is, to go back to episode one, when I said the left is just, mm-hmm. Was it episode one? I don't know. Two or three or maybe something like that. When I was saying that when we first started talking about this stuff, that the left is, the American left is just the child of American Puritanism with grafted onto, yeah. with liberal values grafted on. We're all sitting around praying, you know, for God to bring us a miracle, for the big other to come in and save us, for history. I don't know. I don't think I think the old left maybe could be criticized as waiting for history to move forward. I don't think anybody's got that kind of a mindset. That's where in capitalist realism. But everybody's right. Waiting for some big other, whatever it is, whoever it is. Maybe if, you know, I send out enough of my prayers and do the rosary or whatever by, you know, blasting out tweets, then it will sort of like join together with other people's tweets in the ether enough that like becomes social change. I don't even really know, but.
It's the midichlorians example.
Yeah.
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 Well, because what it amounts to is an implicit belief, even if not an explicit belief, that the problem is people's hearts and minds.
Yeah.
And that if we can change,
exactly.
If we can, from one individual to the next, if we can purge, you know, the bad thoughts that we have inculcated within us as a result of socialization, then we'll be prepared to act together, and then our acting on our collective good thoughts will make a materially better world.
Right.
And like it's not just a slight difference of opinion. It would be a complete different understanding of how things happen. And if that's our left, I don't think we have a future.
I think the
left is part of the slow cancellation of the future if that's the way that it acts.
No, it absolutely is, because the left doesn't. The workers have not become fit to rule. I think there may be an aspect of this
not even
where,
fit to use the fucking internet.
we're conditioned by living in a world that is ruled by others, rather than living in a world that is constituted in our own choices and actions and collective deliberations. And, you know, Marx was real big on, like, the working class has to become fit to rule. It has to enter into its role as the ruling class, which it currently is not. It doesn't exist in that role as it's created by capital. So it like so you know, for example, Capital does have the ability to act decisively when it decides it wants to or needs to. For you know, so for example, for the last 4 years, the left has been pronouncing how evil and Donald Trump is, and how Donald Trump needs to be removed from office. What a terrible threat this person is. And there's been various descriptions of what he represents, fascist to right populist to whatever else. Anyway, about it, I think everyone on the left universally agrees, and I would agree, Donald Trump should be removed from office. The fact is, it doesn't fucking matter what any of us think. Nothing that any of us have said means anything. There's nothing that any of us could do to implement that reality. However, the Wall Street Journal reported today that various industry representatives, such as the National Association of Manufacturers, in light of the events on the Capitol, issued a statement saying that the 25th Amendment should be invoked to remove Trump from office to ensure a peaceful transition of power to Biden. And then it becomes a mainstream subject of discourse that Donald Trump should be removed from office because the capitalist class and its representatives spoke toward this subject. Now, that's an outcome as far as outcome, you know, like at the thing that we want to happen in the world. That's an outcome that I want Donald Trump to be removed from office, but it only comes into existence precisely as far and insofar as the capitalist class desires it to be so.
I don't even know if I can like bother to muster the energy to want that at this point. Like, who fucking cares?
I don't even give a shit at this. Like, you know, like whatever. As much as it makes like MAGA chuds cry about it, then like, cool, that makes me happy. But
sure, but it's got nothing to do with politics.
Exactly.
It's like just, we can at least good. Right. We can at least acknowledge that like what we're talking about is agreements between power brokers, and what we do and think just really doesn't fucking faze them at all.
But you know,
and it could, right? That's the whole idea of a revolutionary subject, is that that the ruling classes would tremble at the communist revolution.
Mm-hmm.
Not that they would take our Lilliputian ambitions and adopt them as, you know, part of the new HR manual.
Hey, that means we're winning though, right?
That's how you know we're winning.
I cite this example in particular to see, you know, to go back to, you know, the suggestion I made just a bit before this, that yes, it is manifestly the case that the capitalist class, when it wants to, can act as a unified class force, because this is, you know, it has the capacity, it has the structural capacity, and it's like, you know, it can do it as easily as I raise my arm. You know, it's just sort of this learned behavior that's second nature to it as a class. The working class doesn't have that as a second nature, but I don't think that undermines that capacity, or the recognition that capacity is there. I don't think that undermines the fact that neoliberalism as an agreed upon ruling class project does seem to be disintegrating.
Sure. That might be the case.
Maybe.
I mean, if we're witnessing the end of neoliberalism, I would still make that, I would still mark a distinction between that and its corresponding outgrowth of a population so completely decimated and atomized, a civic life so utterly buried, and you know, institutions which cohere communities, things like trade unions or, you know, churches or political parties or whatever it may be, even student organizations, right, which at one point in our recent history were the norm. That there was a way that you as an individual related to society through a collective institution, and that even the concept of citizenship was even bourgeois citizenship was understood as a collective experience, that, you know, even if we are witnessing the end of, and really slow end of neoliberalism, it's kind of like witnessing the end of the Trump administration. The effects are already there. It's already accomplished its mission in terms of eliminating threats to capitalism. So, like, if David Harvey's right and that neoliberalism is a political project, not a new phase of capitalism, not like a new, not a new base, but a veneer on the superstructure or an element of it.
Right.
If it goes away, it still leaves the same problems. And all of the same problems.
Yes.
And so
I couldn't imagine anything better coming after neoliberalism, like, on its own.
What, you don't think neo-feudalism is going to be rad?
No, because, I mean, at least the last feudalism, you had, like, fucking cool armor and swords and shit. You know, now what do we have? Like, Tesla and viral TikTok challenges have replaced chivalry and trial by combat, which, I mean, those aren't better. I think they're better. Actually, yeah, they're better.
So obviously, we can lament all of this stuff for the rest of our lives.
And we will.
Yeah, we will, probably. But I think that leads to the Badiou essay.
Oh, Badiou.
What is the current conjuncture? And I think we covered a lot of it, right? He talks about the left as being fully absorbed by movementism, which is polymorphous in content, spontaneous and rudderless, dominated by a strictly negative politics, like against everything but for nothing, and that its achievements have been primarily reinforcing an existing power and adding cosmetic changes to the structures.
Mm-hmm.
We've kind of covered all that. Yep. But he also talks about the possibility and necessity of moving from the negative to grandiose affirmation. Because Badiou is under the impression that the missing element of this subjective factor is primarily a question of will. Right? That's the way I read it. Was that
it sounds Maoist.
Well, yeah. He doesn't really offer any, like, actual slogans, but he does sort of say, like, what we really need is to, and he gives examples of, like, abolition of private property.
Oh, yeah. That's the slogan that's going to cohere the new revolutionary subject.
I kind of see it as being more of the happiness industry socialism. Yeah. It's like, look at how terrible everything is, but look, it's going to get good. What does he say? We're on the cusp of a new global communism.
Yeah. That was exactly...
I don't see it.
That was exactly... I don't know. I mean, I'm always hesitant to just be too, like, blithe about, like, really smart people saying shit or writing things that because I'm just like, I don't know. Maybe they're saying something and I'm missing it or something. Maybe they're saying something more profound. But, yeah, that was...
It's cowardice, Kevin.
I am kind of a coward. But that was my response whenever I read it was... exactly that. Like I was just like, okay, yeah, like you're saying like his outline of like, here's where we are, here's what's been happening. We've the only resistance that we've seen has been pure negation with no positive alternative being asserted, and we've simply seen the negation of these negations repeatedly. You know,
he's like, everything is terrible, and I was like, yes.
Exactly. Everything's just sort of reproducing the existing order, and there's no future. But we're now in like this new entering on the cusp of this new era when like something new, a positive affirmation of, you know, what can bring the, you know, the whatever the revolutionary subject together. And then he was just like, everybody's just gonna do it because communism's good.
Right.
And there was no proposition whatsoever of any like structurally, like what is the social force that will cohere around this demand? What will it look like? What are the steps that would be required to cohere that social force?
What are even the mechanisms of transmission for that demand?
Yeah. Yeah, yeah.
Where's the workers' press?
Just like it, just like emanating into the ether or something.
Well, as far as I can tell, it's that we're meant to fucking post about it. Now, of course, Badiou's not saying all you need to do is post abolition of private property and, you know, death to the bourgeoisie. But essentially, without a constructive proposal, which I admittedly haven't fully worked out myself, right? But without one, that is essentially what we're saying.
But you're not fucking Alan Badiou. You didn't write the article. You don't have to know. He does.
That's right. I don't have to know because I'm not Alan Badiou. No, the thing is, I do have to know.
Yeah.
Because I'm burdened by existence.
Right, and once you fucking figure it out, then you'll write the article.
That's right. but I will try to grapple toward it in the dark.
I was a little annoyed by that article. Sorry.
No, I think it's a fair response. I'm a little bit annoyed by it too
because I thought it was good, you know, until the end. You know.
Mm-hmm. But the point I was trying to make was that I think if someone like Badiou or anyone, pick somebody less prestigious, pick a political figure that's easier to contend with, you know, because you think you're as smart as they are. If the
Chomsky.
Contention that a person's, yeah, sure, I'm, yeah. If the contention that a political
Chomsky,
figure is, if the contention that a political figure is trying to raise is that we have within our grasp, just out of reach, if only we would extend our arms and we could grab onto the future, and that we could recompose ourselves as a collective subject, as not as individual working people, like, oh, I'm in a working class organization because I work at a fucking job, right? No, but as a collective subject, right? As the political expression of people in the workplace to not only defend their interests, but to extend and raise a higher vision of their interests. If that's what you think that we're on the cusp of, or that we're just about to be able to do it, I do actually think the obligation is to spell it out. Because we're all fucking dying to know. That's all.
Because we don't know, because we're still in capitalist realism.
Yeah.
And I think the second anyone's capable of articulating the conclusion to this article that we wanted Alain Badiou to write, that he didn't write, I think that may be an indication that we're headed out of capitalist realism.
That's hope springing eternal. That's some optimism. And you know what we say about optimism here.
Yes.
Fucking kill it.
Optimism is cowardice.
No, look, I think in another discussion, I think it'll be useful to talk about steps, practical steps that people can take to, like, you know, try to do something worthwhile.
I was just going to say, I feel like, I think it was at least three of these articles ended with that really, like, overly optimistic or, like, rosy, like, full of good content, and then just like, oh, it's the power of imagination. And like, I want to know if this is akin to me trying to finish my college paper, or if they like genuinely believe this, because it's just, I don't know. It just like takes all, well, it doesn't take all the power away from the rest of the paper, but it's so, or the reading, but it's like so anticlimactic. You're like, oh, positive thinking, okay.
Yeah, it's happiness industry socialism. That's
it is. It's, yeah, you know, it even falls short of form dream committees.
Yeah.
It's just dream all on your own. It is be an isolated, atomized, neoliberal object of history. But like, be happy.
Yeah.
And project happiness.
Perfect yourself as a subject. You know, you shave away all of the bad parts, all of the negative views that you have, all the problematic views, and properly do the self-effacing flagellation for all of your past, you know, sins. Then you can perfect yourself into the true form of leftist. And then once we've all done that,
yeah,
then that will aggregate to a political subject that can change the world, which is, it's idealism. Nope. It's pure idealism. Yeah. And it's not even cool Hegelian idealism. This is
it's not even cool platonic idealism.
No, it's bad platonic idealism.
It's just shit.
Shitty
man.
Platonic idealism. Shit. All y'all motherfuckers are shitty platonic idealists.
Look, I mean, I think we still need working class organization. We still need socialist politics, which are not just inherited grand traditions. We actually need to slay all the sacred cows. We still need
not vegan
politics, which is we still need a politics of class struggle. But what we also still need is an attitude that we need the grim defiance of the ghetto fighter, and we need to just bury forever the idea that that what's missing is what's funny is just what's missing from our imagination is that practical work that gives rise to an imaginary itself.
Yeah.
Wait, I have a question for you. When I was talking to you before, I was talking about how I don't think I've ever been able to imagine like a concrete like end of capitalism and so on. And you said that you don't think you suffer from the same problem. Can you elaborate? Mm. That might be a good note to end it on because it sounds more positive than anything else we've said.
Ooh, positive?
Yeah. No, look, I can't. So the reason why
the bar is low.
Yeah, it's true. It's just kind of. I mean, let's see if I can drag myself over the bar. I do think that I have the ability to imagine something like the beginnings of a new world, because I think I have seen glimpses of it, and I haven't seen that in the United States. It's not because I've been to big protests or even rowdy demonstrations and even occupations of U.S. government buildings. not even because of that. But because in Venezuela, during election season, when Hugo Chavez was president, I was fortunate enough to witness people, working people, running factories, electing managers of their factory committees, and saying that the future of this country is not just going to be a state capitalism, but it's going to be a socialism like Marx talked about it. These are people who are learning Marx in classes sponsored by their factories after hours. And you know, that the party of millions of working people, with all of their immense and enormous contradictions and problematic natures, being led by people who are from every competing political tradition that in this country would mean they wouldn't even have anything to do with each other. You know, it's homeless people squatting and electing an assembly and petitioning the local city government for funds to build proper housing and getting it because the Constitution allows them to do that. Neighborhoods policed by workers' militias rather than police. A dual power situation, really, where the communal councils existed alongside the city councils, and the city councils had to get their approval for things. Similar to the you know, the way that the city dumas had to get the city Soviets to approve their legislation in early 1917. Now, plenty of that didn't go the way we wanted it to, and it's all a process that's still in motion, and it looks like it's taken many steps back. But what it was real, and it was hard. But it also looked like people in the process of self-actualization. And that's something that I will always carry with me, because it means to me that it is possible, that it is real, even if I haven't seen any of it here, especially in the last few years. But I do think that that it's not just that another world is necessary, but it's also possible. I still do think that. I think the paucity of human material that we have here is in an advanced stage. So maybe I'm a lot like one of those third worldists in the 70s that's like, well, look, obviously the Americans we're not going to do it, but look, they're doing it in Vietnam and in Angola and Mozambique and so on. But it's not that. It's just that there has been an inspiration that I've witnessed firsthand and not just in a book. And that's why I still think I can be not just a nihilist.
Yeah. Also, I just want to, I don't know if this to distinguish this is important, but just to say that I don't, I do think a better world is possible. I just have had my brain rotted by America and like cannot imagine it because I haven't witnessed it like that. So
I just have read a lot of books about Yugoslavia and East Germany, and I think of that, but better.
Yeah.
I mean, I indulge my tanky side a little bit to come up with my imaginary future.
Me too.
I think you have to, because that's what we've got. It's like that's what we have had.
East German, but more communist.
Right. Yeah.
Well, you know.
Well,
like small C communist.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I was just it was just like East Germany, but not like surrounded and embattled and like, you know, whatever.
Right.
War communism and all that. But what was it? Hunter once said, "I think the third worldists might be right, but I don't know what to do about it."